Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto of the National Speleological Society. This is a monthly podcast about cave exploration, and listenership has been growing pretty steadily since we started last July. And while I happily welcome new listeners who perhaps don't have any affiliation with a grotto, that's a local chapter of the National Speleological Society, I encourage you to join a grotto and join the NSS, not only so you can be well-informed on caving safety, conservation, and ecological issues, but also so you can meet other cavers, so you can go more often. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, so do yourself a favor and make it official. Find your local grotto at the NSS website, caves.org. Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you may know that my wife and I have been expecting our first child. Well, Finnegan Douglas Pelser finally arrived last Wednesday morning at 4:16 a.m., and everybody's doing great. I'm adjusting well to fatherhood and having a great time, albeit on much less sleep than I'm used to. Of course, because we didn't know when he was going to arrive, I didn't go caving at all last month, and I probably still won't for a while, but you can bet I'll still be putting out this podcast regularly on the first of every month. I've heard from some listeners on Facebook already. Thanks for those well wishes. I can't tell you how happy I am to finally be a dad. And yes, I'll get him caving as soon as I possibly can. Just give me a few years. This month's interview is a big one. So big that I had to spread it over 2 months. I'll get to that in just a second. But first, the Caving Podcast is sponsored by Swago. You may know Swago as the maker of some of the best wet caving packs ever made. If you know this, you probably also know that Swago has had to stop making packs due to a supply issue, but Scott has been testing new materials to start making packs again. You can follow his progress on Facebook. Just search for Swago, that's S-W-A-Y-G-O, and like the page. You can also visit swagogear.com to buy some of his other products, like chicken loops, little webbing loops you can use to attach gear to your ankles to pull through crawlways easier. You can also use them for vertical climbing assistance. There are a ton of good uses for a chicken loop, and they're cheap, too, $5 each. Makes a good gift for the caver in your life, too. Get a couple of them. Also, for the serious explorer, Swago makes great accessories for your survey gear. Sightlight shields help protect your Cinto compasses and clinometers from the bumps, bangs, and rigors of cave survey, and come with Swago's glow-in-the-dark sightlight shields pre-attached. These are great. They make it so you don't have to shine a second light on your instrument, so you can take your readings through the sight with just one hand. Get it now at swagogear.com and help support Swago so we can get those packs back on the market. Got a quick calendar note before we get started, and this is a little self-serving because this is my grotto's event, but this year is going to be a great one. Indiana Cave Capers, August 4th through the 6th. Online registration is officially open. This really is going to be one of the best capers yet. We're back in downtown Corydon, Indiana at the Harrison County Fairgrounds. One of the entrances to Indiana's longest cave, Binkley, is on the property, though it is definitely not the preferred entrance to the cave. We will, though, have led trips through Binkley at Capers this year and many other caves in the area. And we've been working with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources to get some of the state-owned caves that were closed due to white nose syndrome reopened for the event. Most of those caves are in the beautiful Harrison-Crawford State Forest, an area well known to Indiana cavers. So this year's Cave Capers could be a great opportunity to visit some of those caves that have been off limits in Indiana for years. I'd love to see you at this event. So register at CIGCaves.com. CIG, Central Indiana Grotto, caves.com. Get it out of the way now because pre-registration saves you a few bucks. And don't forget to add your ticket to the banquet and a t-shirt. I'll be personally manning the registration table for much of the event, and I'll be conducting quick caving podcast interviews with whoever wants to talk to me. Maybe that's you. And I'm hoping to take all of that audio and cut it into a clip show for an episode later this year. Again, Indiana Cave Capers will be in Corydon, Indiana, August 4th through the 6th at the Harrison County Fairgrounds near downtown Corydon, which will make it a really very friendly capers for family and non-cavers because the event will be walking distance to a classic American small downtown. Great shops, restaurants. The world-famous Butt Drugs is in downtown Corydon, Indiana. If you haven't seen the Rhett and Link YouTube commercial for butt drugs. It's hilarious. Check that out. So yeah, Indiana Cave Capers, the first weekend in August. I really hope you can make it. Register at cigcaves.com. Okay, as always, thanks for sticking around through the intro. Let's get to this month's interview segment. As you saw from the title, this is part one of what will be a two-part interview with Indiana caving legend Dick Blends. Dick got into caving in the mid-50s. He's one of those guys who's got a four-digit NSS number. He helped to found the Windy City Grotto when he lived in Chicago and, of course, did almost all of his early caving here in Indiana and then bought the Buckner Cave property in the early 60s. We talk about all of this in the interview, of course, but in case you haven't heard of him, I'm just giving you a little necessary backstory. Dick graciously invited me to his house for his interview. We talked in his office for almost 3 hours. And so you're getting the best of the best of what was a really fascinating conversation. If you've listened to this podcast at all, you've probably heard me talk about Buckner. It's probably my favorite cave because of its history and the fact that it's got a little bit of everything with respect to the activity of sport caving, crawling, climbing, boreholes, squeezes, canyons, you name it. It doesn't flood. And of course, all of that can be found around its classic circle route with many more challenges in the farther reaches of the cave. He knew this, of course, when he bought it, and he thought it would be a great place to train people for caving, so he invited anyone and everyone who wanted to try out this caving thing on his property over the years, and Buckner Cave kind of became a sort of proving ground for Indiana caving and just caving in general. And fair warning, we don't mention caving until about 5 minutes in because we started off talking about the early days of his professional career and when he was in the Army and with electronics. It comes into play later contextually, so I left it in there. Just bear with it. So here we go. Hope you enjoy part one of my conversation with Buckner Cave owner and NSS archivist Dick Blends.
I came down here in 43 to be drafted, and halfway through the drafting process, we were taking extensive physicals and mentals and all kinds of stuff. I have a bad left eye. I can't identify you with it, but I can see you. And somebody had written rejected across my papers. I thought, well, I'm going to go back to college. So the last thing that day, late in the afternoon, I was going past some desk and said, let me see your papers. And he looked at them and he says, there is a stairway over there up to a balcony. Go up there, and there'll be an officer up there.
Okay.
All right. So I took my papers up, and he took a look, and he says, I see you just finished first semester at IU. I says, yeah, I got delayed coming in here with that. He says, well, we need smart people as well as the other kind, and he rejected my rejection. And 10 minutes later, I was a private in the U.S. Army. And because of my left eye, they decided to make me non-combat. A week later, I come back down to Fort Ben Harrison on the east side of Indianapolis. And very shortly at the reception center, I was asked the impossible question that very rarely ever gets asked, I think. And the guy, an officer, come up to me and says, what would you like to do in the Army? This was during a war.
Yeah.
And they were looking for people. And I says, well, I thought I would like to maybe be in the Signal Corps because I knew something about radio and all of that. He says, how about the Air Corps? I says, well, I have a bad left eye. I didn't think I could qualify. You know, the restrictions were rather heavy.
Mm-hmm.
He says, do you need two eyes to do electrical work? Electronics, that word hasn't arrived yet. He says, do you need two eyes? I says, no. He says, you're in the Air Corps. Bang, bang, bang,
just
bang,
like
bang.
Like that. Just like that. Wow.
Okay. So a lot of time went by, and I got into radio school, and I got into all kinds of stuff, and then finally became a radar specialist.
Makes sense.
And in those days, that was top secret.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, wow. And the radar was brand new. I finally got sent overseas, and I served in the 100th Bomb Group in England for about 7 months. And then when the war ended, all of a sudden they said, your job description has been declared essential to the Pacific Theater.
See, you're going out there.
So they immediately sent me to Indiana, to Camp Atterbury, and I had no sooner got back to the air base, to Atterbury, we dropped the atomic bomb. And we thought, oh, why, this is the end of it. So 3 days later, we dropped the second one on the 6th, on the 9th. And on the 12th, I was on the way to Sioux Falls, South Dakota for reassignment in a troop train. And we were halfway up through Iowa, and we were stopping every time the train would stop someplace for something. Is it over yet? Is it over yet? Everybody was expecting it. And all of a sudden, the word came through, yes.
Ah, thank goodness.
It was ended on the 12th. So we sat around on the base for a while, and we figured, well, we're going to get discharged. The Army doesn't work that way.
No.
And all of a sudden, I was put on shipping. And I got shipped to a B-29 base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I was there until November.
Mm.
And finally, they had a number system of getting you out of the Army. And finally, I qualified, and they shipped my tail back to Fort Wayne. I was shipped out of the Army. But that's my history of the Army. But
how'd you get started in caving?
After the war, I went back to Purdue and didn't last very long. I decided I didn't want to be an engineer for various reasons. And because I was an experienced technician, I'd rather do it that way. And while I was at Purdue, in our house that we were living in, one of the guys in the house came up to me one day and he says, you have a car. I had a Model A Ford. And he says, you have a car, and I have a family in southern Indiana down here, and I'd like to get down there and get some good dinners and things, and let's go down.
Okay.
Okay. His name was Johnson. So we drove down, and his father said, you guys ought to go caving.
What year was this?
It was about 1952. 1953, right in there someplace.
Yeah.
So we went over to Spring Mill State Park.
Ah.
And climbed around in the cave over there. And, hey, this is a good deal. You know, great. Wow. And that started it. And I started caving a little bit, but not very much. And I quit Purdue and came home while I was in the north end of the country of Indiana, and there ain't no caves near that place.
No.
So I fooled around from 1954 all the way into the 60s, worked with my father in the store and maintained the televisions and things that come, and I was doing a lot of that work. And one day, my mother was looking in the Chicago Tribune, and she says, hey, there's a job offer here at the University of Chicago. You ought to try for that. She always thought the University of Chicago was actually one of the top places in the world to even be associated with. And she was out of Chicago area. So I said, oh, golly, I don't know if I can qualify for that kind of a place. The University of Chicago was considered one of the top-notch universities in the world, especially on research. And she says, oh, call him up. All right. So I called him up, and the guy asked me if I was experienced. And I said, yeah, I have radar and all that stuff. He says, come in and get an interview. Well, I didn't know it at that moment, but he was the man that ran that whole affair at the Enrico Fermi Research Institutes.
Oh, wow.
One of the leading professors in the world in cosmic ray research and stuff.
Yeah.
And he says, come in and get an interview. I says, well, I better be honest with you. I said, I do not have a degree from a university of any kind. I have a lot of experience. And he came back at me, and he shocked me. He says, I am surrounded by degrees around here. He says, I'm looking for people who can do something.
And here you were.
I said, well, I can do something. He says, come on in here. And I went in and interviewed, and 2 weeks later, he gave me the job. I was with them for 11 years and doing high-altitude cosmic ray research from balloons and things. Mm. And it was a beautiful, excellent job. I loved it because I got to fly. I got to fly on airplanes, and I got to recover balloons and do all kinds of crazy things, both here and in Canada. When I joined the U of C, they had something like 6 Nobel Prize winners on the campus.
Wow.
Simultaneously.
Wow.
They consider themselves as a Nobel Prize factory. They still do. And their attitude was, you get your PhD here at Chicago, then go away. Go away. We don't want you here. Get a job someplace. When you earn your Nobel Prize, come back.
Come on back.
And that's a big plus for a university.
Well, I guess so.
They had a whole bunch of them. And finally, about a week after I got to the University of Chicago, that was the first of 1955, somebody come to me and they said, you're from Indiana, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, there are caves down there, aren't there? Yeah. He said, you know anything about them? I said, oh, I've been in a couple of them. He says, let's go caving.
And there we go.
And here we go. And we came down. We started coming down here, and we finally formed the Windy City Grotto.
So you helped form the Windy City Grotto?
Yeah, I was one of the instigators of it.
Wow.
And that was in 1961. Mm. And the NSS had been around since the turn of the war, from 41.
Yeah.
And so we finally decided we ought to join the NSS, and we did, and started the grotto. Of course, we were coming down here, mostly here and Central Illinois and Missouri, and some into Kentucky, and once in a while off into Tennessee. And I decided one day we were building a new building on the back of our facility in Chicago, and they had to close the place down for a weekend on a Friday because they were about to wire the new building into the old building, and it concerned handling 12,000 volt equipment, and so they shut the whole thing down so they could do it. And they suddenly announced, you got a day off with pay. Because the power's going to be off, and there's nothing you can do here. So I come down here, and there was a little house across the street on the other side of that fence.
So you came down here, exactly,
yeah,
here.
So I thought, well, I might as well go down there and go caving.
Sure.
So I came down here, and I was sitting in that little house over there,
mm-hmm.
and there were no fences or gates or anything on any of this. This property had been essentially abandoned. We didn't know who the owner was. We didn't have the foggiest notion. The next-door neighbor, two doors down now, was told to keep everybody off this land. Well, he didn't own the property, and he wasn't too interested in that, but anyway, he was told. And so Buddy Rogers, who was a part of our caving system, had his house three doors down. So we would pull into his place and come across the forest and go caving.
Ah, okay.
And I came down to just look around the community and look around and look for holes and stuff, this, that, and the next thing. And I was sitting on the front porch of that house, and all of a sudden, two cars pull in, a car and a pickup truck. And they pulled in and they stopped. And what attracted me was the fact that one of the cars had a big sign on the side of it that was advertising religious revival. And I thought, what in the heck is this all about? And they got out and they parked their vehicles and they walked off onto this property. And they were gone, and I was sitting there wondering what was going on. Who were these people? Well, I'm not the nosy type. You know, I didn't own those property, but I'd been in the caves there many times. All of a sudden, they came back out. And something, one of these impressions that I get very rarely, but once in a while, that can change your life.
Mm-hmm.
And an impression came across me, said, get nosy. Okay.
Okay.
So I went out and I says, what's going on? And the guy spoke up and he says, oh, I'm the owner of this property. Whoa. Aha. And he says, I'm the owner of this property, and I've been trying to sell it for 6 months, and I don't seem to be able to move it. So I decided to sell some of the timber on it. Well, it turns out that he's a preacher in Crawfordsville, Indiana, up halfway between Indianapolis and Chicago.
Sure.
And why or how he was, to this day, I don't know how or why he ever owned this property. But he says, so I decided to sell some of the timber, and this fellow with me was a pickup truck from a timber firm that was here in Ellettsville, and he had come in to look at the timber, and they were looking at trees. Well, he said it was for sale. My brain started to churn right away, and I suddenly says, what do you want for this place? I figured it would be an outrageous price because he couldn't sell it. And I says, what do you want for this place? And he says, it is exactly 50 acres. Give me $7,000 and you can have it.
Which, with inflation, is about 40 grand today?
I don't know.
Yeah.
He said, give me $7,000. I want $1,000 in cash, and I'd like to have an income once every month just to add to my income at home. So I thought about that for about 20 seconds, and I said, sir, you just sold this place.
1961, 62?
This was in 1962.
Gotcha.
And I said, you just sold this place. And he looked at me, and he smiled, and the guy next to him, he didn't smile. And he looked at me, he says, would you be willing to sell the timber here? I says, no, I think I'll make a project out of it of some sort. I said, no, no way. So he got disgusted. He got in his truck and he drove away.
Oh.
And there I was. And right, so I says, I told the preacher, I'll hunt you up in Crawfordsville and bring you a check, and so on and so forth. So he was about to leave and he said, oh, I better be honest with you. There's a big hole on the back of this property that may affect your wanting it.
You bet it does.
Yeah, I guess. I says, it's okay. It doesn't bother me. I didn't tell him that if that hole hadn't been there, I wouldn't have been here. I wouldn't have had anything to do with the property. So that weekend, I went home up in the Calumet, and I announced to my father that I had just bought a 50-acre piece of property. And he said, it's about time you did something with money. And I didn't have very much money.
Mm-mm.
But I got a loan from the bank, and next Monday I went down to Crawfordsville and searched him out and gave him a check. And it was about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. And he was real happy about it. And he said, I'll call my lawyer. And he called the lawyer, and the lawyer says, meet us over at my office right now. This was after supper. So we went over to the lawyer's office, and they had all the papers made out, ready to sign. I signed. I became an owner of the property. And when it was over with, I hadn't thought of this, but when it was over with, the preacher asked the lawyer, what do we owe you? Uh-oh. And the preacher says, oh, give me $10. The lawyer says, give me 10 bucks.
All right.
So I got this place for 10 bucks. And that surprised me. So I started coming down here and for 4 years.
Living in Chicago, coming down here to Cave.
Coming down here about twice a month.
Mm.
And it's a 400-mile trip you know, all over down here and back and all that. I was wearing out automobiles. So one day, we had a day off for some reason or another. So I came down here, thought, well, I'll go caving. Brought a couple of guys with me, and we came down. Got down here, and it was raining like hell. And I thought, oh, heck. Suddenly, I had one of these impressions came across my mind.
Another one.
And the impression says, why do you have to work for the University of Chicago? What's wrong with working for Indiana University?
Right down the road.
And I thought, you know, that's not a bad idea. That I suppose that was in the back of my mind because, after all, I had bought this place. So it was raining, so I went back into town and hunted up the personnel department. It just happened to be in a store building across the street from the main entrance to the university. So I got parked, and I went into the place, and I says, are there any electronics jobs on this campus? He says, yeah, we have about 10 electronics shops on the campus. I says, well, are there any jobs ever available? He says, one came in this morning, a request, and he reaches over, and he picks up the card, and he says, this job came in this morning from, he says, I don't know anything about it, excepting that it's the physics department.
All right.
So I walked out. He took me out to the front gate, go up there and find out what this is all about, and I'll know more about it myself. Okay. So I goes up the physics building, roamed around. I had never been in the place, roamed around looking for an office or something. Finally came across an office. I walks into the office, and there's two ladies sitting there, secretaries. I says, I have a slip here for a job offer. And she looked at me, and she said, boy, that was fast. Usually it took them weeks, you know. She said, that was fast. She said, I'll take you into the office. Dr. Langer was the chairman of the department. And I went in, and he shook hands with me, and he sat me down. He says, you're an experienced technician? And I says, yes. I gave him, you know, I was in the Army and all that. He says, who do you work for? I says, the University of Chicago, John Simpson. And his eyes lit up like two light bulbs. His eyebrows rose right away. He says, oh, yes, we know of Simpson's work. He got up, and he walked to the door, and he called one of his secretaries. He said, would you call John Simpson at the University of Chicago?
Uh-oh.
On the telephone. And I thought, uh-oh, what am I getting into?
Calling the boss.
Shortly, the phone rings. He picks it up. He was faced away from me at his desk, and they were talking. He talked on that phone for 10 minutes. And he was writing things down on a piece of paper. And all of a sudden, he hangs up, and he turns around, and he says, you have this job if you want it.
You're all set now.
I says, but for once in my life, I was speechless. And I says, well, I haven't talked to Simpson or anything at Chicago. And he says, I think Simpson knows all about it. What a way to get a job, to have your new boss tell your old boss, you just quit. Well, Simpson was extremely happy about that. He was the sort of a leader that never tried to hold anybody back. If you could do something better, fine, great. So I went back, and I resigned my job, and he sent me off with celebration, and I came down here. But I got my job because I had worked for the University of Chicago. That was all it took. That word, U of C. So I had my job here and moved down here. And then in 1974, my father was a builder and decided, I want to build my last house right here.
1974,
we finished this place.
Oh, okay.
75, actually, 74. And Dad and I built this house with our own bare hands. This house is cost me $16,000 for the materials.
Wow.
$16,000. When I took it in to have it insured, it took 2.5 years for us to finish this place. I took it in to have it insured, and the insurance company said, it's worth $60,000. I said, well, this is a neat way of making money. Well, I wasn't about to sell it.
No,
I was going to live here.
And you haven't yet.
And so I had started developing this place for caving.
Let me ask you about the cave itself. I mean, what about Buckner Cave do you just love? I'm sure there's a lot of things.
Buckner Cave has been known for a long, long time. When we first went in there, the place had been marked up quite badly. And
in the early 60s, it had already been marked up a lot.
And the there was a so-called signature room, which we don't call it that anymore.
L.V. Cushing room.
And on the ceiling, people had put candle marks to identify. And there was two candle marks, which are still there. And one of them was, they were just names of people.
Yeah.
But it was dated 1835.
Wow.
That's 16, 15 years after the state became a state. And we thought, this is neat. So we took those two names. Somebody took them into the courthouse and searched through the records to find it. And it turned out one was a county coroner and one was a county sheriff. And what they were doing back in Buckner Cave, I have no idea. And in those days, lighting and stuff was
very primitive.
Open torches and things.
Yeah.
And so the cave has been known for a long, long time. And but it essentially had been closed up, sort of. It has a large entrance room, big enough, about 4,000 square feet of floor space in that place with 30-foot ceiling that you can walk down into.
Mm-hmm.
From there, it's a crawlway for 698 feet. And then it opens up into essentially 3 miles of walking around passageways and things.
Mm-hmm.
Crawlways and climbs and
a little bit of everything.
A little bit of everything. But nothing dangerous. The cave is not a flutter.
Drains very well.
A very, very rare cave that can be declared a non-flutter. In fact, we warn people, be exceedingly careful, because that's how we drowned. That's how we end caving.
Right.
We've had 5 deaths in Indiana on our records, and they were all drownings.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just 2 instances of caving. So the cave was very nice to have because it was a good cave for training.
Mm.
And so we've been doing that. And at one time, we were getting 5,000 people a year in here to go caving. And the whole idea was to develop a facility to train people into caving. And I think we gained a lot of people for the NSS. Many years later, I was at a convention in California. We have a national convention every year.
Sure.
Someplace in the country. And this was within California. And somebody came up to me and they said, I started caving in Buckner Cave.
Like so many others.
Yeah. And I looked at him and he says, where are you from? He says, Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I says, well, how come you were in the Buckner Cave? He says, well, I happened to go to Indiana University.
Aha.
And he says, you can't escape caving when you're in Indiana University.
Uh-uh.
And so he joined the grotto and all of that. So we added a lot of people to the caving fraternity, and we still do.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you've seen every part of Buckner Cave?
Oh, yeah.
You've been in
many
part of it.
Many times.
Yeah.
There's a lot of little side passages, and you never know when you're going to find something new.
Yeah.
Caves are funny.
Yeah.
We had surveyed and mapped that cave, I think, for the 4th time. And suddenly one day I went caving with three or four guys who wanted to go, and I thought, well, I'll take them around the circle route.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been in there?
Oh, yeah, many times.
Okay. So we go into Buckner. At the end of the crawlway, you walk. If you go right, you go down to the stream. You go left, you go around the circle route.
Right.
So we decided to go left. I was walking along, and all of a sudden, a guy disappeared. I noticed he wasn't there. And I, what the heck's going on? So I turned around, and I walked back, and I was yelling, and suddenly I get a voice coming from a hole in the ground. There was a little ledge you climbed down off of, and he had noticed the rock, and he pulled it out, crawled in there. He found new passage. It's on the maps.
What was that on the map? Do you know?
It's just a unnamed passage. It's just a crawlway, and it has water in it and so on, and it goes back for quite a ways, a fairly long little passage. Actually goes underneath the entrance crawl. And
it must be Gurgling Spring. Is that what they call it? Gurgling Spring?
Yeah, that's Gurgle Spring.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, you're well acquainted with it. yeah, that was it.
I've got the map of Buckner, Sean's new map. I've got it blown up on my garage wall, so I stare at it all the time.
Okay, fine. I keep forgetting you're a major caver.
I wouldn't say that, but I would say Buckner is my cave, like my favorite cave, the one that I visit most often.
Yeah. So the cave can grow.
Yeah.
You never know. For instance, I took a couple of guys in, and we did the circle route, started it in. We got to the big room. You have to crawl up and go into a crawlway. Well, you can go to the left, and there's a passageway, but it finally terminates.
Yeah.
But you can walk through it. I got over there, and we walked down that passage. And all of a sudden, again, there was nobody behind me. This is what happens when you take inexperienced people, newcomers to the cave.
Mm-hmm.
They get nosy.
Yeah.
They look at everything.
Sure, as they should.
And we old-timers kind of forget about that. We go through the cave, and we really don't see it anymore. And suddenly there was nobody behind me, so I turned around and walked back, and I yelled out, and I got a reply from up in a hole in the ceiling. And what the heck is this all about? So I goes up there, and here's a room. It's an empty room up above a pile of breakdown, and you can sit up in there. Two or three people can fit in there real nicely. And he was up there, and he was sitting up there, and he'd seen this thing. He climbed up there to see what was going on. And we have that named.
Keen's Grotto?
Keen's Grotto, yeah.
Okay. Was he Keen?
His name was Keen.
Okay. I've always wondered how these rooms got their names.
Yeah. And we found that and put it on the maps.
That's great.
So I've been in every possible corner of the cave. You can go downstream, follow the river, and finally it'll get into a long passage, mm-hmm. the river passage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a tough passage. It's walking, fairly narrow, but it's got little bridges across it, and you have to climb over them or go under them or some darn thing. And finally you come to a waterfall.
Yeah.
And you go down the waterfall about 15 feet.
Yeah. We'll climb
down.
You
can follow the cave for a while, and then finally it closes down too low.
Mm-hmm.
We often remarked about that place because if anybody ever got injured in there, we would figure how we would ever get them out.
Yeah.
In a stretcher. You know, it'd be almost impossible. We'd have to have a doctor come in and do the servicing.
Mm-hmm.
But we had that passage there and explored the cave all over the place.
Mm.
I like to do things that are unique.
Of course.
I'm the prime one person in the entire country that knows, is supposed to know, where every cave in this nation is and a description of it.
That's amazing.
There are many people that, like the CIG, that carries the state files and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm the only person in the country that has the whole damn thing. I'm one of 11 people who spent 3 weeks in a cave.
Mm. Wow.
Sullivan.
Mapping Sullivan. Yeah. I just did a trip to the Rise in February.
All right. The year before, there had been an expedition of teenagers decided to go down and explore and map the cave. And they stayed for 2 weeks. And they made quite an expedition out of it and succeeded in producing a pretty good, quite a bit of map and so on and so forth. The next year, they decided, let's do this again.
Sure.
And finish up the problem. There was a lot of work that still had to be done. And Sam Frischauer,
he drew the map,
said, let's join that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we went down, and this was for 3 weeks. We spent in Sullivan Cave, got beyond the beyond, got into the northern part all the way to as far as we could get.
Yeah.
Did mapping and surveying for 3 weeks. And so I'm a member of a very unique organization, the Sullivaneers. 11 people.
Yeah.
There are cases in the country where individuals have stayed for a year in a cave by themselves. Been two or three of these have occurred. But nowhere has there been a case where 11 people as a large group stayed for that long.
Yeah.
We are now getting surveying being done, one survey being done, and some people have been down for 2 weeks.
Lechuguilla?
Things like that.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether Lechuguilla or that could be part of it. So I got that on my record. 3 weeks in a cave. And we came out, we went in on August the 10th, 1963. And I had my birthday down there on the 21st is my birthday. And we came out 3 weeks later at the end of August. And Armstrong came down and brought a
Bob Armstrong.
Yeah, Armstrong. A hearse. He collected hearses.
What?
He collected all kinds of things. If you ever want some interesting, look into his history. The man was absolutely crazy, but he was a great caver.
Yeah, yeah.
And but he lived up on the north side of Indy.
Yeah.
He brought a big hearse down, a pink hearse.
What?
And we all got into that thing. We all had beards. I had a beard. I'd grown for 3 weeks down there. And a bunch of other kids, and we all had our helmets on, and he had a cannon on a trailer.
Yeah.
And it was hooked to the back of this hearse.
Yeah.
And we drove all the way up to Indianapolis and drove around through town with this thing and looked at people's reactions. The craziest nonsense ever. And it was funny. Policemen and stuff never even noticed it. It was strange how reactions we got from that thing. That was how that all ended.
Mm.
And we had taken exams and stuff, mental exams and everything, and they looked at the results to see what our attitudes and things had changed, and it was quite involved.
Yeah.
So I was a part of that nonsense. And that cave, Sullivan, still promises to go.
Oh, I know.
But going beyond that water entrance is going to be a tough one.
Yeah. Beyond the rise at the very back?
At the far end where Sullivan River comes into the cave.
Yeah.
And up to that point, the place is a borehole.
Yeah.
I can drive a freight train through some of it.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether anybody will ever push that thing or not. It'll take a major project.
It would take a lot to get equipment back there to try to dive it.
Yeah. But we had fun with it. In 1974, about the time I finished this house, My father died suddenly from a heart attack, and my mother wanted to go to Florida to stay on the property that they had owned down there. And so I took her home. I took her down there to stay. So I was at a Caver get-together at Caver Valley in, down south.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly Tom Ray, who was the chairman of everything in the world.
Caving related, yeah.
Tom Ray come up to me and he says, "How would you like to be the National Cave Files archivist?"
Sounds like a big job.
I said, "Well, it sounds good." I says, "What does it consist of?" He says, "Answering questions and keeping the records for files." So I said, "Okay." So a few weeks later, I wasn't living here. This wasn't here yet. I was about to move here, but Mom and Dad had moved down to Highland Village here to be 200 miles closer to Florida, which they spent all winter in. And so I went back. I was living in Highland Village here, and suddenly 6 filing cabinets shows up. So I was in the cave files business. There is now 16 filing cabinets filled in the basement right
down
here.
In the basement right now.
And I am still the National Cave Files archivist. We have something on the order of 59,000 caves on the books right now.
Whew.
I have them all right here on this computer and in paper in downstairs. And the NSS has suddenly decided to expand, and they had moved to Huntsville, Alabama. And a couple of years ago, they decided they would expand, and they bought a new piece of property down there, a new headquarters. And so I went down and took a look at the place, and they decided to conglomerate all services to the new facility. I am still waiting for them to call for the national file.
Do you hear
We're
that?
All still waiting for this.
You hear that, NSS?
When are we going to do that? Because that's going to be a major move. We got 16 full loaded filing cabinets plus other equipment that's got to go to Huntsville, Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a box truck out Eller Road. Make it happen.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. We're officially waiting now for them to make a move to decide how they're going to want to move all this stuff and the whole procedure for it. So I'm hoping that because I'll get a new basement available.
You have all kinds of room. What are there some other caves around? I mean, there's plenty of other caves around here.
Yep.
What were some of your other favorites around the area, Garrison Chapel area?
The next cave north is Wayne,
mm-hmm.
which is still the longest cave in the county.
Yeah.
About 4.5 miles of it. Have you been in there?
Yeah, I have.
The tough crawlway?
It is.
Yeah. Finally, the cave was bought by
IKC.
So it's protected. But there was Wayne's, and there was Salamander,
mm-hmm.
Coon, and Grotto, and gosh, I can't think of them all. And there's about 360 caves in the county.
Yeah.
And I have it all right here on the computer. And this does not rank us number one in the state by a long ways.
No.
Harrison County down in, on the river
mm-hmm.
Has, 600 caves in it or something. And we were on what is called the Crawford Upland that crosses the Ohio River near Leavenworth. And as it moves, it stretches north. At Leavenworth, it's about 35 miles wide east to west. It's a ridge of limestones that's sitting above the base rock. And as it moves north, it gets narrower. Down there, it's about 35 miles wide. Up here, it's about 6 miles wide. And when Caves of Indiana was published, we had, I think that had 398 caves in it, was essentially everything we really knew about, mostly on the Crawford Upland. There are now 3,300 caves on that same area. The upland goes north up to Greencastle, mm-hmm. and then it dips under the overburden from glaciers.
Yeah.
And on the Crawford Upland, there's probably 2,700 caves. Mm. And then there's a small upland to the southeast, Miskatatuck or something they mm-hmm. call it. And that's got about 400 or 500 small caves in it. Nothing major. So most of it is on the Crawford Upland.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you go south into Kentucky, it spreads out and on into Tennessee. And Buckner Cave sits in the same rock that Mammoth Cave sits in. The area is a very extensive one.
Mm-hmm.
And the rock extends all the way over to Missouri.
St. Genevieve limestone.
Actually, the St. Genevieve limestone got its name from Missouri.
Yeah.
And that's what we have here underneath us. Many of the hilltops, including this one, have a sandstone cap over the top. Here it's about 35 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
And this house is sitting on sandstone.
Mm.
If you go out across the road here and walk down the hillside, you'll come to a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sandstone cliff.
Ah.
And underneath that is the limestone sticking out. And the water coming down gets charged with carbon dioxide from all this coverage, becomes carbonic acid, flows off to the edge of the sandstone, drops into the limestone.
Carves it out.
Cave.
Yeah, there you go.
We used to go down roads on the Crawford Upland. We used to go down roads and stop about every third farmhouse. You got any caves around here? Yeah, there's one up on the hills behind the barn. I'll have my kid take you up there. And we'd go up there, and I'll be darned if there wasn't a cave entrance. And the farmer knew about it, and he put a fence around it to keep his animals out of it.
Sure.
But otherwise, nobody knew about it. And we found a lot of holes like that. There's caves all over the place. So we used to do a lot of that. Well, that sort of thing has been going on the eastern part of the country. Missouri, of course, on the west of the Mississippi, but just barely. But I've calculated here, of the 59,000 caves that we have in the country, 2/3 of them are east of the Mississippi River.
Really?
Include Missouri on that.
Yeah.
Even though they're west. But Missouri and all the rest of the country, 2/3 of the caves are east of the Mississippi. The rest are west and are spread out rather all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
The number one cave state is Tennessee.
Of course.
I have 10,360 caves listed in Tennessee.
Wow.
They have one county. They have one quadrangle sheet. There's something like 300 caves on that sheet.
Wow.
And they come under the rules that were set at TAG, the TAG area.
Yeah.
Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia.
Yeah.
They have the rule set that if a cave is not either 30 or 50 feet deep or 50 feet long, they don't count it. And this is 300 and some caves in on a quadrangle sheet.
That they are counting.
That are counted.
Amazing.
And you wonder,
yeah,
where do they have space to put a house? They don't, really.
They don't, no.
And that whole area down there is like that.
Wow.
And it stretches from Maine down the Appalachian system and into the Ozarks.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we've been searching over for many, many years.
Yeah.
And I think we're finding them.
Yeah.
This is a problem because out west, things are still going pretty strong. It's a big country out there. Americans don't realize how big this nation is. And west of Kansas or something, the amount of space is fabulous.
Yeah.
And a lot of it has caves in it.
Mm.
Not so much down in Kansas and Nebraska, no. But as you get back into the mountains, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was sitting here one day with the National Files, and I get an email from Belsky. Belsky is the guy who takes care of the files of New Mexico. He sent me a list of 20 new caves. I got them up there. 20 new caves. I thought, well, that's neat. You know, wow. So I dutifully put them on the file and forgot about it. About 4 months later, he sends me a list of 20 new caves. Hey, that ain't the same list.
We got 40 new caves.
Yeah. What's going on? So I got on the email and I said, what are you doing out? What's going on? I mean, in Indiana, we ain't going to find a new cave in the next 10 years. And he says, this was in the summertime, and he says, it's been fabulously hot down here where he was. We've been going up into the mountains to cool off. And guess what?
We're finding caves.
We're finding caves. He says the areas are abandoned terrain, which nobody has been in for years.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, miners went out to look for gold and what have you. And the Indians had abandoned the place. And he says, it's just empty country. Miles and miles and miles of it of valleys in between mountain ranges and stuff. He says, it's surprising how much of this country is really isolated.
Yeah.
And he says, we're finding caves. Well, he's added over 100 caves. I get a list from him every once in a while now.
Wow.
And it's just automatically, he puts it in. They've got 2,800 caves in the state now.
Wow.
And, of course, Carlsbad Caverns and things are major ones, but they're still finding stuff. And then they found Lake Aegelia, and that was a major, major find. Here's a little hole blowing 40 miles an hour wind.
What in the world?
We got to look into this one. And all of a sudden, it's 125 miles of caverns.
Amazing.
Ranking second or third in the country, you know. Caving is interesting. You get to a place like South Dakota. North Dakota has 7 caves. North Dakota's a big state.
Yeah.
It's twice the size of Indiana.
7 caves.
South Dakota is a big state.
Mm-hmm.
South Dakota is caveless,
except
for 4 little counties in the southwest corner.
And there, it's...
all the rest of the state is useless for caves.
But
and
that's
that southwest corner.
Oh yeah,
there are 2 caves in one county: Crystal and
Jewel.
Yeah, Jewel and Crystal. Those two. That county has maybe 200 caves in it, and none of them. Particularly, you know, they're nice caves and stuff. They got caves, but fine. They got nothing spectacular, particularly, except for these two. And they are world-class caverns.
Yeah.
Over 150 miles each.
Still being pushed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And still being pushed and ranking 2 in the world, virtually, you know. And you wonder, what's going on out there? You know, where they throw the averages all cockeyed, you know, suddenly you think, boy, South Dakota has some real caves. They ain't got nothing except for that corner.
But those are amazing.
Yeah. It's an amazing place. So we had a convention down there on one of our cavers' communities. In fact, my red shirt came from that convention.
Ah.
And so it's still an interesting area, and people are still trying to push those 2 caves, which is getting very difficult because it's a big project every time you try to do something. The interest in caving is not there as it used to be. kids are now stuck on their little machines.
Yeah.
I don't own one. I'm an electronics specialist, and I don't own one of these damn things. I don't have one of these phones.
Yeah.
I just don't want to be bothered by it. But these kids, complete computers, I will admit, these little phones are remarkable computers.
Of course.
Absolutely astoundingly remarkable. And they're getting better and better. You know, here you have a really up-to-date computer sitting in your pocket. And I don't understand some of it, you know, how they managed to do this. The technology has essentially up and left me sitting here with transistors. But it's really remarkable what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the NSS numbers, we got just over 10,000 people. It is now down to 9,000 something.
Mm.
And you're not going to join the NSS to be able to go out and find a cave.
Mm.
There ain't none to be found.
You're gonna join to do it.
So what we're trying to do is to get people interested in preserving what we've got.
Yeah.
And mapping it and surveying it and looking at it and protecting the wildlife and the bats and whether you can get people into caving with that kind of an interest, I don't know.
Mm.
But I think what has happened is that we have actually, as far as Indiana is concerned, has essentially caved it out.
You think so?
There's obviously possible caves. Things show up.
Sure.
Witness the big hole underneath the car museum in
in Kentucky, yeah.
I went down there when that occurred. And amazing, absolutely astounding what happened and didn't kill anybody.
I know.
God, you couldn't have made this happening on purpose,
no.
Planned any better. But anyway, we have had in Indiana essentially six grottos from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Always the CIG, the BIG a little later, and others have shown up. And then, I help add the Windy City Grotto to that. The fact that we found 3,300 caves in an area that had 300 and something, 400 caves, it's been pushed pretty hard.
Yeah.
And we're getting to the point all over the eastern end of the country that we've essentially found everything that's worth finding.
Mm.
Something may open up, and on occasion does, and you have to be ready to look at it. But this business of walking out over the country and finding a big cave is not going to be easy anymore.
There you have it. A great introduction to the man, the myth, the legend that is Dick Blenz. I hope you enjoyed it. I can assure you that next month will be even more interesting as we talk about the more sordid history of Buckner and its reputation that it got as a party cave as a result of the unfettered access that he allowed until he donated the property to the NSS and the Richard Blenz Nature Conservancy was set up. We talk about the most serious rescue that ever took place at Buckner Cave, and we hear his thoughts on a man he says he'd rather forget about.
He created a lot of problems. In fact, I think it was the cause of three deaths.
That and more coming next month in part two of my interview with Dick Blenz. Of course, if you'd like to visit Buckner Cave, you can request permission at bucknercave.org. Make sure it's at least a week in advance of your trip. And hey, thanks for listening. I really love doing this podcast, and I've gotten a lot of great emails from listeners suggesting guests and praising the show. I honestly didn't expect such a big response from the caving community, and I just want to thank you for that. If you'd like to shoot me an email, you can do so at alpineproductions@gmail.com. That's alpineproductions@gmail.com. If you're willing to be on the show, I'm always looking for guests. Now that I'm a new dad, I've got a lot less time to devote to the show, and it's a lot easier if the guests come to me and I don't have to go hunting for them. So reach out to me. I'd love to hear from you. Of course, you can support the podcast by supporting our sponsor, Swago. Visit swagogear.com. If you haven't joined your local grotto yet, you can find it at the NSS website. That's caves.org. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.